Hi, everybody, and thanks for coming to our panel today. This is a panel discussing Mormon apologetics and, in particular, recent events, though I think our panelists will use recent events as a lens to discuss some of the broader issues in apologetics. So I'm Kaimi Wenger, and we have several excellent panelists who I'll introduce in a second. But first, let's go through some basics. You've heard this already if you've been in a panel before, but just to recap a few things. First off, please take your cell phone and put it into the silent or vibrate position. If you don't do this, we will send Lou Midgley and Dan Peterson. No, we won't send anybody after you. please do that so that it will not be disruptive. We have three excellent speakers and a couple of other brief housekeeping notes. This is being recorded, so please don't say anything that you don't want posterity to hear. Please, when we do get to Q&A, we'll ask you to come up and speak into the microphone so that the recording is understandable for all of posterity. When you do get to Q&A, we'll have a couple of other just brief announcements there. But for now, let me introduce our panel, and then we will begin. So my name is Kaimi Wenger. I am an associate professor at Thomas Jefferson Law School, and I blog at Times and Seasons, and I've blogged at some other websites as well. I'm mostly here to just observe. I'll have a few comments and mostly observe these people who are real experts in the field, starting with Kevin Barney, who has published extensively 15 articles through the Maxwell Institute, is on the board of FAIR, is currently the chair of the board of Dialogue, and has extensive experience in the apologetic conversations that have taken place. Bridget Jack Jeffries, is an MA candidate in church history at Trinity. She is a BYU graduate. She blogs at the excellent Clobber blog and also at the brand new Worlds Without End, right? Group blog, and has been a very astute observer of issues relating to Mormon apologetics for a long time as well. And finally, John Charles Duffy, who is an American religious historian, has an article, Defending the Kingdom, Rethinking Faith, How Apologetics is Reshaping Mormon Orthodoxy, did appear in the 2004 May issue of Sunstone. So these are going to be our panelists. We're going to each speak for a particular amount of time, and then we'll open the conversation for Q&A, and I'll begin with a few remarks. So why are we here? The immediate cause of why we're here, or the immediate source of it, stems on a set of events that happened about a month and a half ago, between June 14th and 22nd, a series of public events involving emails, message board posts, and ultimately the public announcement from the Maxwell Institute, an article by Peggy Fletcher Stack, and a variety of conversations about events within the Mormon apologetic community, focusing on a potential change in direction, or at least this is how it has been characterized. There are potential criticisms of that approach, some of which we'll see. But what we saw during that time, and there's an excellent summary for those of you who are not completely up to date on the series of events that happened, I recommend that you do go to Jack's blog, Clobber blog. She's collected a series of the events, so we can see there's a June 14th post, there's a June 15th post. There are some problematic sharings of private emails, which raise at the very least some serious ethical concerns. And ultimately, the sharing of an email from Dan Peterson to Gerald Bradford saying, and I'm going to read just a few small portions of it, you've achieved your goal, I resign, that this was done in a somewhat underhanded manner of removing Dr. Peterson while he was out of the country and unable to defend himself, that this is part of an overall process of the change in the review, and that this is, quote, coming immediately after my public crucifixion over the John DeLynn debacle, that this is It was a very emotionally intense email, to say the least, and was immediately posted to various internet forums and has led to a variety of conversations. And let's talk about a little bit about the conversations that have happened and then about what they might mean. So in an article by Peggy Fletcher Stack, John DeLynn, who is the proprietor of Mormon Stories, said, and I'm quoting this, "I've had enough conversations with general authorities to know that they don't view ad hominem attacks as a constructive way to do apologetics." So at least some observers, John DeLynn being prominent among them, but several others have said this is a deliberate move from the church to distance itself from a particular type of apologetics characterized by at least the work of Dr. Peterson and probably also the work of other certain high-profile figures such as Lou Midgley within apologetics. That's a narrative which has been discussed. On the flip side, there are potential counter stories. And a counter story which has been raised in a number of other forums is that this is a perhaps an overly bureaucratic move, that this is the homogenization of the church in a sense, that maybe farms never should have been under the official church, under as an official branch of a church organization anyway, that perhaps the freewheeling style is a little more suited towards a private organization rather than a branch or a something with church imprimatur on it. And this has led to, for those who have followed the conversation, it's led to about 1,000 blog posts. If you take a look at Times and Seasons today, Ralph Hancock has a follow-up on this, and if you take a look at Millennial Star or Viacom and Consent or any of the other blogs, you'll see numerous conversations about this. An excellent write-up at Jack's blog as well. Can't say enough good about what you're doing at Clobber Blog. So a couple of things just to try to tease out some of the themes that have come up in these conversations, and I don't think that I have all the answers, but it appears that people are saying a couple of things. The first is that there are two basic approaches to having apologetic discussions on the internet, and I don't know whether I agree with this, but a number of people are making this descriptive claim, and one of those approaches is perhaps very aggressive, for lack of a better adjective, very harsh, and perhaps unfairly, perhaps partially fairly, Dan Peterson, Lou Midgley, others have been labeled with that label as the aggressive apologists, and that this is therefore a sort of deliberate move away from aggressive apologetics. And this has sometimes been coupled with scriptural claims. Jesus wouldn't be an aggressive apologist. These people are not Jesus-y. Which is, I think, a problematic claim to make because there's obviously a whole variety of different scriptural accounts which can be imported into the conversation about apologetics, some of which are more lovey-dovey and some of which are less lovey-dovey, and Jesus certainly had his moments. So I think it is a somewhat overstated claim to say that Jesus would not be mean like this, when in fact Jesus was mean on occasions. So that is something which has, and particularly focusing on John's claim, is this a deliberate move from the church away from an overly mean or overly aggressive approach to apologetics, or is it just bureaucracy, infighting, palace coup, however you want to characterize it, but something which shouldn't be seen as a deliberate move from the organization to try to delegitimize a particular approach to apologetics? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that arguments are being made on both sides, and that's probably the key issue here, or at least it seems to be to me. And it focuses on, because really this conversation has been happening for years, right? When you go back to Midgley saying Signature Books is an anti-Mormon press, when you go back to reviews of Todd Compton's book, there's been this narrative that Farms is being overly harsh to certain organizations, certain people, people or organizations who are viewed as insufficiently supportive of the church. And that itself raises the question, what is the role or what is the purpose of Mormon apologetics? And I'm asking a lot of questions. I don't have to answer any. I'm hoping that our smart people here will at least give some guidance here. But so one recurring question, do the ends justify the means? if one thinks, and I don't think one has to think, but if one thinks that some of these conversations have been overly harsh, have been overly strident in some way, if at the same time those harsh or strident conversations have resulted in more people staying within the LDS community, is that a win or is it not a win? And I think depending on one's perspective as to what the role of the LDS community is and what the role of apologetics is within that community, there are very different potential takes there. One claim which has been made, which I think has some validity, is that the harsher aspects of apologetics tend to have a delegitimizing effect on, or try to have a delegitimizing effect on certain people within or without the community. So some people it's easy to delegitimize. It's easy to delegitimize Ed Decker. He doesn't know a thing. Some critics of the church who raise really overly broad criticisms and say, you know, Mormons all have these certain ideas, those are easy to target. But other people seem to be saying, I'm not Decker, I'm not trying to completely tear down the institution, but I would like to change the direction of the institution. And I think it's clear, at least to me, that some people, John DeLynn, Joanna Brooks, others, are perhaps interested in conversations which might change the direction of the way the community is moving. Is the role of the apologist not only to defend against Tanners, against Deckers, but also to counter potential people within the community who would like to change the direction the community is moving? And I think that's at least what seems what this particular controversy has been about, is whether Farms has been too harsh towards those types of actors within the community. And frankly, we see this as well with the recent Ralph Hancock, Joanna Brooks conversations, if anybody has followed that, that Ralph at his blog has repeatedly made claims about whether Joanna Brooks is adequately Mormon enough, and made a statement to the effect that one cannot be a member of the Mormon community and be an LGBT rights advocate to the extent that Joanna Brooks is, and whether that is a legitimate role for apologetics, to say this person is not really within the community, that sort of boundary policing. So I think there's a wide variety of potential perspectives one can have here. One thing which Ralph Hancock said recently on Times and Seasons is that it's about the truth claims, and that Ralph Hancock sees himself as unwilling to set aside Mormon truth claims in favor of a sort of more neutral approach, a more Mormon studies-y approach, and that as far as he's concerned, the starting point has to be, and I'm summarizing a very long discussion, the starting point has to be the church is true. And from there, let's use that as a conversational baseline, and the perception that perhaps others within the Mormon studies conversation are not starting from that baseline. And if that's the case, then maybe it's a fundamental disconnect. Maybe it's not possible to have conversations if we don't agree on the baseline. So at this point, now that I've asked a whole bunch of impossible questions, I hope I'm just trying to frame some of the issues. There's a whole lot going on in this discussion, but I'd like to turn the time over to Kevin and see if I can get a few answers for some of these questions, because I'm as curious about the answers as the rest of you.
Hi. This is my vacation, so I didn't really prepare anything to say. I plan to just talk off the cuff a little bit. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about what apologetics is. As Kaimi said in his introduction, I'm involved in an organization called FAIR, which is the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. And I was not involved at its origin or when they chose that name. And in retrospect, it maybe wasn't the wisest name to choose, because for years we've gotten emails on a weekly basis, why are you apologizing, you know? Because apologetics is a word that's not really native to the Mormon tradition. It's a well-known word in other religious traditions, but to Mormons it's not. So you should understand that the word apologetics ultimately comes from the Greek word apologia, which means a defense. And the word apologetics means or refers to that branch of theology that involves defending religious faith by rational means. And there are Mormon apologists. There is a Mormon apologetics. There are evangelical apologists, Catholic apologists, and Jewish apologists, and Muslim apologists. And basically, if you're a religious group and you try to interact with the world, you probably need some form of apologetics. So that's the first thing. Second, in Mormon discourse, a lot of times the word apologist is thrown around as a slur. And I personally don't perceive it that way. And part of that might be, you know, Jack and I both have a background in classics at BYU. And I remember reading Plato's Apology. Apology in the original sense, not the modern, I'm sorry, I won't do it again sense. So to me, being an apologist is a perfectly honorable thing. It's not something one has to be ashamed of. Also, another point I want to make is I think a lot of people wear different hats at different times. I certainly do. I sometimes act in the role of an apologist and wear that hat. I also act in the role of a scholar, and I wear that hat. You know, I've published like 30 articles in Mormon studies, and some of them have an apologetic slant, and some do not. I wear the hat of a regular member. I teach gospel doctrine in my ward Sunday school. I wear the hat of a social critic. I'm a blogger, but by common consent, some of you may be familiar with that blog. And in the world of apologetics, there's a spectrum of belief and practice. And in the world of apologetics, I've got to be on the very liberal edge of what one might call an apologist. Kaimi mentioned LGBT rights. You know, I'm right there with Joanna on those issues. And probably, you know, Ralph Hancock obviously is not, if you read his post in Times and Seasons. So there's a wide spectrum of kind of belief and practice among apologists. So what I'd like to do now, in the wake of what happened at the Maxwell Institute, a friend of mine, Russell Arvin Fox, who's a political scientist at France University, he sent around an email to about 15 of us, and just kind of wanting to get our thoughts about apologetics. And so I responded with an email, and so I want to kind of give you the gist of that email that I sent to this small group. And what I said was the way I think of Mormon apologetics, I view it as working in kind of three different spheres. And first of all, there's what I call, and these labels are just my own that I made up for my own purposes. The first is what I call engagement apologetics. And but what I mean by that is it's where you engage directly with the critic or whoever you're talking to. And so I think of that's like debate. You know, when Kaimi is talking about this aggressive style of apologetics, that's really where that kind of falls. You know, I think of that as like rhetorical combat in the octagon. It's you know, two people enter, one person leaves. You know, that kind of mentality. And today, a lot of that takes place on message boards. That's kind of the venue for this style of apologetics. And Personally, that's not my style. I don't really engage in engagement apologetics. Part of the reason for that is I know myself to know that well enough to know that I wouldn't be very good at it. I'm just an empathetic person. Dan Peterson, Lou Midgley, I know those guys. I'm friends with those guys. And I don't view them as the Antichrist. But I know everyone else too, and I'm friends with everyone. So I don't really want to wrestle around in the mud with people over these issues the way some people do. So that is a style. It's kind of a message board. Yeah, I don't really like message boards very much. I'm more of a blog person. You know, some people just have different personalities. So it's just not my personality. I'm a live and let live kind of guy. So there is that one style of apologetics. There's also what I call scholarly apologetics. And we're going to hear from John Charles in a little while. I'm sure many of you read his very lengthy Sunstone article. And I read it at the time and then thought it was insightful, but I reread it in preparation for this, and I thought it was not only insightful, but perhaps prescient in a way that we wouldn't have known in 2004. Because he talks about, he kind of lays the land of the apologetic landscape in Mormonism, but he talks about a couple of tensions, and one being with, there's kind of an anti-contention tradition in the church. And this kind of harsh style kind of butts heads with that. And there's a tension there. There's also an anti-intellectual tradition in the church. And apologetics, by its nature, uses scholarship. And so it's very very open to scholarship in a way that traditional Mormonism really hasn't been. And so there's a tension there as well. And John Charles kind of concludes that apologetics in many ways has been a progressive influence of the church. And I agree with his conclusion there. And I mentioned this article because I was going to talk about scholarly apologetics. And he suggests that's not really apologetics. He calls that orthodox scholarship. And I agree. I think that's a perfectly good label for it. But for this purpose, just to try to situate everything, I am going to refer to it as apologetics. And by scholarly apologetics, I mean what I think of as kind of classic Farms. Farms is the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, a private foundation organized by John Welsh in 1979. And that Farms was eventually absorbed into BYU in the 90s at the request of President Hinckley. And it's kind of hard to say no to President Hinckley if he asks you to do something. And I'm not part of Farms, but I know those people. And I know that at the time, it was not a slam dunk decision to go into BYU. And I think there was a lot of concern that what has happened recently would happen. Farms would lose some of its independence. So scholarly apologetics is applying the tools of scholarship, but making assumptions about Mormon faith claims. So assuming that the Book of Mormon is in some sense an ancient book. But once you make that assumption, then treating it the way a scholar would otherwise. And so it involves things like peer review and source and site checking. And footnotes and lots of linguistic tools and dead tree publication. And so, like Farms would, put on a conference on the allegory of the olive tree. And they would invite scholars. They would hold a two-day conference. And then they would publish the proceedings in a book. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about by scholarly apologetics. It's not directly engaging anyone, but it's providing a scholarly apparatus around Mormon faith claims. And then there's a third type of apologetics, which I call educative apologetics. And that's really what I see as the role of FAIR, at least today. Now, FAIR originated almost exclusively as an engagement apologetics organization. FAIR is kind of an internet-based organization. It was, and I wasn't around when it was first organized. But what happened was, on the old AOL message boards, there were religious discussions, and the Mormons were being pushed around. I mean, they were the 98-pound weaklings getting sand kicked in their face because they didn't control the venue, and these people that did, would control their access and things like that. And so FAIR originated as a group of people, banding together in self-defense, electronically on the internet. And so FAIR had, created its own message board. And it, in those early days, it was very much this engagement apologetic style of, let's arm wrestle over this stuff. And that lasted a few years. But then FAIR made a conscious decision to abandon that style. FAIR actually gave up its message board. Some people still refer to it as the FAIR boards, but it hasn't been that for a decade. I don't remember the exact year, but something like a decade. And FAIR's mission changed to being one of engagement apologetics to one of educative apologetics. So FAIR's focus is inward. It's on ordinary members of the church. And its focus is on helping them when, this primary teacher is preparing a talk. And she opens up Google and she inserts some innocuous search term to prepare for her talk. And she hits enter. And somehow she goes down some rabbit hole and she finds out some weird thing about the church she's never heard before, and she's freaked out. And so now what? Well, in the Mormon tradition, what do? Well, you go talk to your bishop, right? And her bishop's an engineer. He's got an engineering degree from BYU. He's never heard of this thing. He's of no help whatsoever. And probably no one in her ward is of any help whatsoever because no one's heard about it. Where does she go? What does she do? And that's where FAIR tries to help. FAIR has a wiki that it has developed over time, using wiki software and wiki editing and collaborative editing, crowdsourcing, that sort of thing. Over time, the FAIR wiki has become a repository of responses to basically any anti-Mormon claim or argument you can think of. So now if you want to know what all of those anti-Mormon claims are, you can go to the FAIR wiki and find them out too. So some people think that's a bad thing because you're giving these people, anyone who wants to, a smorgasbord of anti-Mormonism. But I think you got to do it because people are going to find this stuff. We live in the internet age. When I was a missionary, the only way you got anti-Mormon literature is if you looked for it, or if your crazy Aunt Sally sent you a tract in the mail. That's not the case anymore. You've got the internet, baby. I mean, everyone is one search away from finding all kinds of weird stuff. And we've got a lot of skeletons in the closet, and we've got a lot of bodies buried in the backyard. And we haven't been very forthcoming as a church about all that stuff. And we kind of hope that maybe people won't find it and we don't have to talk about it. That doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't work anymore. Someone has to be able to talk about it. And so that's kind of the goal of FAIR. FAIR also has a feature called Ask the Apologist, where if you can't find what you want on the wiki or whatever, you can write in, and there's about 100 volunteers on a private email list, and those questions get sent to those volunteers, and someone will actually respond to your question. I've probably answered 1,000 of those questions over the years, and I love doing that. You know, someone is troubled by something, and a lot of times it's just putting it in a matter of context. You know, it's people bring these black and white fundamentalist assumptions, and they're very presentist about our religion, and so sometimes you just got to, you know, bring a little historical consciousness to it. And it's actually a virtue when you practice that kind of apologetics to be familiar with the literature. I've been reading Dialogue and Sunstone and Journal of Mormon History and everything else for decades. And so I'll remember, oh yeah, there was an article about that. And a lot of times I'll send someone, here's a link to an article, read this, and then if you still have more questions, write me back. So that's kind of the world of apologetics as I picture it. And there's all kinds of different, you know, schools of thought and ways of practicing it. And I do think there's a role for this engagement apologetics. And when most people talk about apologetics here, that's what they're going to be talking about. Whether that should be under the umbrella of a university, I don't know. I'm a little ambivalent about it. And I can understand the Maxwell Institute wanting to go a different direction. If this takes place, my guess is Farms will become an independent foundation again, probably under a different name, and continue, you know, doing what it had done before. That's just a guess. Anyway, those were kind of my thoughts on this subject, and so I will sit down and go have on.
Hey, you guys. Well, Kevin's probably going to be a hard act to follow, but I'll try. I did prepare something, but it's probably not going to be as good as what Kevin says, just talking off the top of his head. But I want to start out by saying that something that may not have been too clear from the introduction of me is that I've never been LDS. I did go to BYU, and I'm married to an LDS guy, but I guess I'm a Gentile is what it's called. And I attend Trinity Evangelical Divinity School right now. I'm an evangelical Christian and a member of the Covenant Church. So what the heck am I doing up here? I'm really just a longtime observer of LDS apologetics. I first began learning about and reading Mormon apologetics when I was 16 or 17, thanks to the internet. The internet's a wonderful thing, isn't it? So I've just been watching LDS apologetics for a long time. I've been friends with a lot of people that I would consider apologists. I volunteered for the FAIR conference in 2003 and 2004. And was even asked to introduce a speaker back then. A couple of years ago, I had a friend at BYU contact me because there was an evangelical church that was trying to get him and another friend to come and participate in a mutual interfaith dialogue. I asked who the evangelicals were that they were bringing, and I don't want to name them, but they were two of the most well-known people in the countercult industry, and they were definitely not the kind of people I would think of for mutual interfaith dialogue. So I told my friend, absolutely not, don't do it. And I told him also to contact Dan Peterson if he needed more information about these people. And he contacted Dan. And at the time, Dan told my friends that, I was told that he spoke very highly of me. So at the time, I was very friendly with LDS apologetics and in a good place with LDS apologetics. So that's what I'm doing up here. As a Christian, I believe in and have been helped by Christian apologetics. So I wanted to start out by talking a little bit about what Christian apologetics is and the goal for that. As Kevin said, the Greek term apologia means defense. And I remember one of my professors at BYU gave a really great analogy on the difference between apologetics and apologizing. He said an apology, you know, it's an expression of regret. I'm sorry I stepped on your foot. An apologetic is, I stepped on your foot because you left it in the middle of the aisle, you moron. So that is a really good way to remember the difference between the two. That was Eric Huntsman, by the way. That joke goes to him. Anyways, but I wanted to make the point that apologia doesn't just, it's not just about defending something, though. An apologia is the act of, it is to give a reasoned argument while presenting evidence for something as though you are arguing in court. So it doesn't just have to be responding to criticism. It is to make a reasoned case for something. Christian apologist William Lane Craig defined apologetics as that branch of Christian theology which seeks to provide a rational justification for the truth claims of the Christian faith. Apologetics specifically serves to show to unbelievers the truth of the Christian faith, to confirm that faith to believers, and to reveal and explore the connections between Christian doctrine and other truths. In Christianity, I would say that apologetics has probably a threefold function. It has the function of making a rational case for the faith to unbelievers. That is supposed to be one of the functions of apologetics. It also has what it's probably most commonly associated with is the function of defending the gospel against attacks from critics. And third, it has the function of strengthening the faith of doubting believers, maybe because they ran across those attacks from critics, maybe because of other issues. But that is the threefold mission of apologetics in traditional Christian theology. And like I said, as an evangelical Christian, I've definitely been helped by the contributions of Christian apologists at different times in my life when I've been facing doubts. I wanted to make the point that examples of apologetics can be readily found in the New Testament. This is what evangelical Christians usually say when they back up the case for apologetics, and I think that Mormons can borrow from this. In the wake of Pentecost, the book of Acts records that the apostle Peter appealed to the evidence of the witnesses of the resurrection in the face of an unbelieving crowd after Pentecost. That would be an apologetic to say to people, we have witnesses here who have seen the resurrection. This is our evidence. He made a reasoned case for the faith. On multiple times, Paul is recorded as going into synagogues and engaging with the Jews there, using scriptures to reason with them on his belief in the resurrection. The disciple Apollos is referred to as having refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. Several of the New Testament writers engage in an apologetic for the nature and purpose of their writing. Some famous examples would be John towards the end of the gospel, saying that he has written this that you may believe, and the same with Luke at the beginning of his gospel, or, you know, if you want the author of these gospels, if you want to be more liberal about the biblical criticism there. The authors of these gospels explained, they gave a reasoned defense for why they were presenting this gospel evidence. Sorry. I should have worn my glasses. I bring all this up because I think that any person who professes to be a disciple of Christ and a believer in the Bible can make the compelling case for the spiritual value of engaging in apologetics. So I believe that my LDS friends do have a spiritual mandate, or that there is spiritual value for them to do apologetics, to do Mormon apologetics. But there are other questions at hand. What is the relationship between scholarship and apologetics? Is it scholarship? In what ways have apologists been effective, LDS apologists, been effective in engaging and participating in scholarship? In what ways have they failed? How well have they implemented that threefold mission that I outlined above? So I wanted to talk about the tension between apologetics and scholarship. Now, scholarship is to look at the evidence for something and then build a thesis. I mean, in theory, this is what it is, right? And then to build a thesis, create a thesis after looking at the evidence. Apologetics, on the other hand, starts with a presupposition. And then you gather the evidence, you muster the evidence to defend that presupposition. So they're kind of at odds with one another. As I see it, apologetics is not scholarship in the classical sense of the term. However, apologetics can still be scholarly because it can muster scholarly evidence. And an argument is an argument, a case is a case, no matter what your presuppositions were coming into it. So if an apologist, you know, engages scholarship respectfully and does a good job of mustering the evidence, he or she can still be relevant and still warrant engagement from other scholars. I wanted to talk about what I have seen as some of the problems in apologetics and its aspirations to being part of scholarship and part of the wider world of Mormon studies. One of the issues that I have taken with apologetics as I've read and observed it has been that almost any person who disagrees with apologists is quickly labeled an anti-Mormon. The Current Fair Wiki, citing Dan Peterson, says that the hallmark of anti-Mormonism is an agenda, whether covert or openly expressed, of combating the faith of the Latter-day Saints and opposing their church. So by this, when apologists call people anti-Mormons, they're saying that they are acting out of an agenda against the church, as opposed to simply stating their beliefs from having examined the evidence. Some examples. The other problem with this term is that I believe it has very pejorative connotations in LDS discourse. Back in the 90s, one of the first websites that I began to read was Gary Novak's Worst of the Anti-Mormon Web. Anybody remember that? And it had a saying on the site that said, it was called Novak's First Rule of Anti-Mormonism, and it was that as soon as you become an anti-Mormon, you lose 85 IQ points, or in other words, God strikes you stupid. So that's not a nice thing. You can't say anti-Mormon is this neutral term just meant to denote something which happens to work out to opposition to Mormonism, and then in other areas be going around saying anti-Mormons are stupid. You're building up very negative connotations for these terms and then applying this label to people who just want to engage the arguments. I feel like it's become very widespread in apologetic discourse. Again, I'm an evangelical and I pay attention to these things. Carl Mosher and Paul Owen wrote a paper in the late 90s called Mormon Scholarship, Apologetics, and Evangelical Neglect. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with it, where they had a lot of high praise to say about Mormon scholarship and apologetics. It was overall a very complimentary paper. It kind of rebuked the evangelical community and encouraged them to engage Mormon scholarship. But this paper was described in the Farms Journal by, I'm going to botch this name, Tibetanese? Am I saying it right, Kevin? Tibetanus? Okay. Tibetanus and Roper called their paper, quote, a call for better anti-Mormon attacks by evangelicals. So the signal was apparently out. Evangelicals aren't even allowed to engage LDS scholarship respectfully without being labeled anti-Mormons. Another example can be found in Matthew Brown's review of David John Berger's The Mysteries of Godliness. It opens with the claim that Mormon History Association President Reed C. Durham had, quote, agreed with the anti-Mormon allegation that Joseph Smith plagiarized ritual elements from Freemasonry and used them to create the endowment ceremony for the Nauvoo Temple. I see this as well poisoning, to take positions like that, which people have arrived at based on scholarly analysis, and say, oh, you've agreed with the anti-Mormons. So I feel that LDS apologists need to watch very carefully whom they're accusing of agenda and not do it as much. Other accusations of agenda happened. For example, quite recently in 2012, an article that appeared in the Journal of Book of Mormon and Other Restoration Scripture by John Yee accused up-and-coming Mormon studies scholars Chris Smith and Andrew Cook of, quote, being bent on proving that the Horos scroll was not the long roll. So it's not just the result of their honest analysis of the evidence. They have an agenda to prove things that way. I don't feel that these kind of accusations of agenda have much place in scholarship, or they should not, and they shouldn't really have a place in apologetics either. Apologists should just be addressing the arguments and engaging in a reasoned case from that, not poisoning the well with accusations of agenda. What I feel that LDS scholarship did really well, oh, and I need to say that not all apologists are like this. I think Kevin Varney is just a model of a really good apologist who is both really good at engaging the evidence, and he's very gentle, and he is very reasoned and logical, and he uses scholarship. And, you know, I'm kind of a curmudgeonly person. I have a dark passenger, and Kevin is just one of those people that I look to that reminds me to keep my behavior in check and be more Christ-like, and that's totally what I think of Kevin Varney, and I know he's Mormon, and I still think that, so. Yeah, Kevin lives about a half hour away from me. I'm very fond of him. What I think apologetics has done well is that it interested a generation of young LDS scholars in entering relevant fields on history and biblical studies. Recently at the blog Faith Promoting Rumor, which is just an excellent, excellent blog that you should all check out, a poster named TT did a post wherein he mentioned that young LDS scholars were originally inspired by the exciting scholarship Farms was pursuing and energized by the rhetorical volleys. These young scholars headed off to graduate school optimistic about what they would learn. They've studied linguistics, biblical studies, American religious history, and Mesoamerican studies. So I think that Farms has done a really good job of publishing a lot of new material and doing just basic Mormon scholarship and energizing people, getting them interested in this and wanting to study these things. However, T.T. also pointed out that these young scholars have often become disillusioned with their Farms mentors. A point that I made recently elsewhere was, I'm 30, by the way. I should be old enough to know that the age question is optional, but I'm 30, and I'm friends with a lot of young Mormon studies scholars, people in their 20s and 30s, and I don't know of a single person who is really setting out to seriously be involved in apologetics. Most of the people getting their degrees in New Testament studies or Old Testament studies or American religious history, most of the Mormons who are doing serious work in these fields are not interested in apologetics. They have said no to following in the footsteps of Farms. And I think that the apologetics community needs to take a good hard look at that and ask themselves why nobody is interested in following in their footsteps, because without heirs, without proteges, without people to follow after them, the journal's only going to go as long as the current generation of apologetics would live anyway. So I feel like part of the reason that they haven't been interested is because of some of the antics that they've seen apologists engage in, and they're not interested in being a part of that. And I'm not sure that the apologetics community is doing a good job of making the case that you can be involved in apologetics and not be involved in what Kevin described as aggressive attack style apologetics. So in closing, I wanted to say that the final thing that I don't think that apologetics has done well is that first point that I listed on the apologetic mission. I don't think that Mormon apologists have done a good job of making a persuasive case for why an unbeliever should believe in Mormonism in its own right. My question and my challenge for Mormon apologists would be, why should I, as a Gentile, as a never believer, why should I be Mormon? It's a question that any unbeliever should be asking Christian apologists. It's a question that any unbeliever should be asking Mormon apologists. And I feel like Mormon apologetics has focused too much on defense of and engagement with critics and not enough on building the case for Mormonism in its own right. Thank you for your time.
Questions that was posed in the abstract for the session is, what is the role of apologetics in Mormonism? And that's the question that I would like to address today. I'd like to point to a couple of historical factors that I think have been crucial in producing the recent surge in Mormon apologetics that we've seen since the 1980s. There are various factors I could point to, but I want to point to the ones that I think are probably the most significant. When you look at the history of Mormon apologetics, it's clear that from the inception of the movement, Mormons have been interested in marshaling corroborating evidence for LDS claims, most specifically around the Book of Mormon, apart from the kinds of spiritual experiences that we think of as testimony. This includes interest in ancient ruins, Indian lore that seems to corroborate the Book of Mormon, passages in the Bible that people have read as prophecies of the Book of Mormon. The testimonies of the witnesses have been a very important apologetic tack over the years. Much of this kind of apologetic scholarship, which has been, I shouldn't call it apologetic scholarship, much of this kind of apologetic discourse, which has been flourishing from the 1830s forward, has until recently been fairly unsophisticated and naive. But increasingly in the 20th century, and especially after the 1980s, there's a real surge in both the quantity and the sophistication of LDS apologetic discourse. Farms has been the premier center for the production of that kind of, now I can call it scholarship. Fair, I would say, has probably been the second most significant distributor of Mormon apologetics. Fair operating in a decisively less, deliberately less scholarly mode, trying to reach a sort of broader audience. And I think there are a couple of factors that help to explain that surge. The first one we're going to talk about is the evangelical surge of the 1970s to the 1990s. Conservative evangelicals in this country increased in numbers during that period, and they increased in visibility during that period. This is one sign of that, though not the only sign, is the emergence of the moral majority in the New Christian Right, for example. Part of that visibility involved the way in which evangelicals began harnessing new kinds of media outlets. There was a real growth in the evangelical publishing industry, new nationally syndicated radio shows, televangelism, the internet. Part of that evangelical surge involved an increase in what Bridget refers to as the evangelical counter-cult movement, which is a branch of evangelical apologetics, which is specifically focused on critiquing the claims of minority religious movements in the United States. And elsewhere in the world, but I'm an Americanist, so I kind of focus on what happens in American history. Mormonism is, by some measures, the single most targeted movement by the evangelical counter-cultists. And so in this 1970s, 1990s period when evangelicalism is growing, counter-cult anti-Mormonism is also growing and becoming increasingly visible as it moves into publishing and radio and television and the internet, which means that Mormons are increasingly likely to encounter it. Part of the reason for that growth, too, has to do with the fact that Mormonism itself was experiencing dramatic growth in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world after the 1960s, becoming increasingly visible. And so evangelicals saw that growth and perceived it as a threat that had to be combated. So the surge in apologetics we see after the 1980s is partly a response to the surge in evangelical countercult anti-Mormonism. The idea is that Mormon apologists feel that these claims being made by evangelicals, which challenge Orthodox LDS claims, need to be met. And a model here that I think is helpful is to talk about apologetics ad extra, which means apologetics aimed at outsiders, and apologetics ad intra, meaning apologetics aimed at insiders. And it seems to me that when you look at the kind of apologetics that the evangelical counter-cult movement produces, much of that is framed as, or presents itself as, an apologetics ad extra. In other words, it's aimed at people outside the evangelical community. It's aimed at Mormons. Much of this apologetic literature is intended to convince Mormons that their faith is flawed, and thus ultimately to bring them to evangelical Christianity. Now, it doesn't exclusively do that. I mean, a lot of that material is also speaking implicitly to evangelicals and reminding them why they should not think Mormons are Christians. But much of it is framed as a conversation directed at Mormons. The Mormon counter-apologetic that you see at farms and fairs seems to be different, because much of that literature, it seems to me, is framed quite overtly as an apologetics ad intra. In other words, it's designed to assure Mormons of the intellectual validity of LDS Orthodox claims. I think it's interesting to be aware of that dynamic, because what it means is that evangelical apologetics vis-a-vis Mormonism are quite assertive, with a very clear conversionist goal. Whereas the kind of apologetics produced by Farms and Fair is much more of a defensive activity. I mean, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence suggesting that Mormon missionaries use apologetics ad extra, trying to use it to convert people. But there's always kind of a stigma surrounding that, and that's not certainly what Farms and Fair present themselves as doing. So there's a certain defensiveness built into the Mormon apologetic endeavor because of this dynamic, which I think is useful to be aware of. The second factor I want to talk about that explains this surge in Mormon apologetics after the 1980s has to do with the dramatic expansion of higher education in the U.S. during the 1960s. This has to do with the fact that baby boomers are going to college, but it also has to do with the fact that colleges are growing. The federal government is pumping lots of money into colleges so they can expand and produce a generation who can help us beat the Soviets into space and so on. And so what this means is not only after the 1960s do you have greater numbers of Americans going to college, but a greater proportion of the American population is also going to college. And Mormons participate in that general trend. And this produces an expanded intellectual class within Mormonism, an expanded proportion of Mormons who are college educated, which is to say, an expanded proportion of Mormons who have been socialized into academic ways of seeing the world and academic ways of knowing. They have internalized those academic ways into the way that they make sense of the world. This becomes a problem because the contemporary academy does not affirm an Orthodox LDS way of seeing the world, things like the historicity of the Book of Mormon, for example. And so Mormons, the growing number of Mormons who are now thinking in academic ways because of their college socialization, now experience some kind of tension, some kind of dissonance that they have to find a way to resolve. Now, some have resolved it by essentially letting the academic worldview dominate and say, okay, fine, I don't think that LDS claims are literally historically true. And some will then leave Mormonism, and some who still want, for some reason, to identify as LDS will have to come up with a liberal reading of the religion. But then you have other folks who want to continue to identify as Orthodox LDS, which means they want to insist on the literal historical reality of LDS faith claims. And that's where apologetics comes from. Apologetics is the effort to reconcile LDS Orthodox faith claims with these sort of academic ways of knowing. No, it's to show that LDS claims about the histories of the Book of Mormon, for example, are compatible with academic scholarship, academic ways of learning about ancient America or whatever. Now, This means that apologetics is a really important sociological function for many college-educated Mormons who want to continue to identify with the church. If you're Orthodox LDS, you are a minority in society. That means you live in a society where the vast majority of people don't share your beliefs. I'm pulling here from work in the sociology of knowledge. Sociologists have looked at how it is, what are the sociological processes by which people's beliefs are formed. And the basic premise of that is that your beliefs are undergirded by social relationships. Sociologists call these plausibility structures. The plausibility structures are the social relationships you have that confirm your beliefs as normal and credible. Now, if you live in Utah, you have a really strong LDS plausibility structure. You are constantly surrounded by people who affirm Orthodox LDS beliefs as normal and credible. If you live outside Utah, or if you are a Mormon who lives in Utah but who has socialized into the academy, either because you are a professional academic or because you've gone to college, you've incorporated the kinds of ways of knowing and seeing the world that you learned in college, you have now begun to affiliate with a different kind of plausibility structure, that is to say, the social networks of academia. And you then have to figure out how you're going to function in both of those plausibility structures at once. What I see Mormon apologetics doing is constantly, it's creating a plausibility structure that reasserts the validity of Orthodox LDS beliefs for people who are also moving much of the time in plausibility structures that don't affirm those beliefs. One term that's used to describe this is apologetics creates a universe of discourse in which Orthodox LDS beliefs are affirmed as normal and credible. But because Mormons are a minority in their society, it takes a lot of work to keep that universe of discourse going, which is why LDS apologetics is constantly producing new stuff all the time. That universe of discourse has to constantly be maintained. Now, lest some of you start feeling smug about that, let me point out that if you are a Mormon liberal, you have a very similar problem, because you are a minority within Mormonism. And so you also need to find networks like Sunstone, where your worldview is kind of constantly being maintained, the universe of discourse that does that, and there are blogs that do that, and so on. What does all this mean, then, in terms of the recent, making sense of the recent flap at the Maxwell Institute? Well, as Kevin was pointing out, I argued in an article I wrote some years ago that apologetics has always been problematic for Mormons because of this tradition in Mormonism that condemns contention. And particularly when Farms was first getting going, it had to quite overtly respond to criticisms that you people are contending and that's a bad thing. They had to defend their more contentious approach. And there's an anti-intellectual tradition in Mormonism which says that, you know, scholarship shouldn't matter, it undermines faith. And there were people at CES and the BYU Religion Department, for example, who looked very suspiciously at what Farms was doing. He was convinced that Farms was a slippery slope into unbelief because of their intellectuality, which also is kind of weird in retrospect, but that was the way it was perceived at the time. So this, I don't want to try to read too much into what's happening at the Maxwell Institute, because I think that does have a lot to do with sort of individual personalities. I don't think we should sort of read it as a larger sign of what's happening in the church as a whole. But it does seem to me that what's happening there is partly a reflection of the anti-contention tradition. I think Bradford is uncomfortable with the more aggressive style associated with the Farms Review. It also has to do with the fact that Jerry Bradford at the Maxwell Institute, I have no inside knowledge here, I'm just basing this on the documents that have gone public, but it seems like he wants to see the Maxwell Institute, which Farms is a part of, become an institution that can be academically credible, that will produce the kind of scholarship that non-Mormon scholars will take seriously. And he senses, and I think he's right about this, that apologetics is not going to fly. I mean, the apologetic endeavor is not part of the mainstream of religious studies. This is something that goes on in divinity schools and places like that, kind of on the edges. And certainly the more contentious sort of apologetics is not going to fly if you want academic credibility. At the same time, though, it seems to me that sociologically, apologetics serves needs within Mormonism. I'm not entirely happy about that, but that's the reality. And yeah, something like Farms is going to have to continue to exist. Something like FAIR is going to have to continue to exist. It may not happen anymore with BYU's imprimatur. And I think that's something of a setback for apologists. I mean, when Farms became part of BYU, that was certainly a feather in their cap. It was a sign of, you know, official approbation for the apologetic endeavor. And now the opposite has happened. Now that feather has kind of been withdrawn. And Dan Peterson, in some of his emails, was very much aware of that, very worried about how this will be interpreted by the people he sees as critics and enemies of the church, and how they will now use this to sort of undermine the legitimacy of Farms. And there's some truth to that, I think. But there's no question that people who want to identify as Orthodox LDS, but who at the same time have been socialized into academic ways of knowing are going to need something that will keep producing a universe of discourse, a plausibility structure that will let them reconcile those two identities in the way that they want to. And so something like the Farnsworth Review is going to have to continue to exist in some form, even if it's now just moving to the internet and doesn't have BYU approval anymore. All right, that was my sort of scholarly reaction to this. I'm now taking off my scholarly cap. Okay, I'm going to unbutton my top button here, Sean. Changing identity a little bit. We won't go any farther than that, though. No one wants to see that. I want to talk a little more personally now, and this will be my final soapbox. And this is a soapbox I give every time I'm invited to speak about apologetics at SenseTime. And I guess meet anyone who agrees with me on this, which is why I'm going to keep saying it, in the hopes that eventually someone will come to me and say, yes, I agree, and then I will know that I will feel my life being worthwhile. Everything I've just been saying, my own view on apologetics and its function in Mormonism, is shaped by two things. It's a convergence between, on the one hand, my understanding of the social construction of knowledge and plausibility structures and all the stuff I was just talking about. For me, though, that converges with a kind of romantic slash Nietzschean slash existential individualist tradition. And what that means is, in my view, my soapbox, it seems to me that when Orthodox Mormons experience doubt, that is to say, when they're experiencing dissonance between Orthodox LDS claims and constructions of reality coming from other quarters of society, the ideal solution is not apologetics. The ideal solution is for people to believe what they believe and not worry about what other people think. Thank you, thank you. In other words, to put in LDS parlance, get a testimony, by which I mean attain clarity about what your personal convictions are, and then have the Nietzschean strength of will and the chutzpah to just blow off people who want to argue with you about it. Unfortunately, there are within LDS culture certain authoritarian and conformist strains which work against developing this kind of defiant individuality. My very judgmental take on all of this is that people who are looking to apologetics for answers to their doubts are looking for someone who will tell them what the right thing to believe is, and they're not shouldering the existential burden of going to God for their own answers. And it seems to me that if apologists really want to help people who have doubts, what they should not be doing is giving them arguments designed to persuade them of LDS orthodoxy. They should be urging them to go to God for answers, for their own answers. The reason apologists don't do that is because apologists are convinced that they already know what answer God is going to give. I'm not so sure of that.
So thanks to our excellent panel of speakers. I think we've heard a lot of really good material here, and I'd like to invite members of the audience to ask questions. At this point, a couple of things. First, if you have a question, please come up and say it into the microphone so it can be heard. Second, I'm going to be a little strict on time. Please don't give a long, rambling monologue. At about the two-minute mark, I'm going to start throwing things at you. So, and third, I would like to give precedence to people in the room, several of whom are here, who have been involved in the recent events, should they like to make a comment or question. So with that, I'll turn the time over to the audience. Yes, please come up and let's queue up and let's give precedence to those who have been involved in recent events if they would like to say things. Would you like to come up and
start. John Charles, question. We just came from a segment that Randall Smith gave insofar as the church's trying to market its image, and the question I have for you, I guess these other two can jump in, but I think it's more appropriate for your take on it. The church sort of incorporated farms, called it the Maxwell Institute. My question is, to what extent do the brethren or the church embrace, bless, support, or otherwise give a nod to farms or fair?
Well, I don't pretend to have any inside information on that, but just trying to analyze what we can see of their actions. My read of the incorporation of farms into BYU is that had a lot to do with farms' contribution to the Dead Sea Scrolls Project. I think that really convinced church leaders that this was a project, this was an organization that was doing work that the church would be very proud to sort of claim as its own. I sense the apologetic endeavor has always been somewhat if you're about. Again, I don't want to try to read what happened at Maximum Institute most recently as a sign of a larger policy shift, but it would certainly be consistent with reservations that church leaders have expressed over the years about the apologetic endeavor being contentious.
I just want to add something on the FAIR aspect of that. FAIR is always very clear. It's completely independent of the church. And it has to be. The reasons we've just seen what happened with the Maxwell Institute at BYU. And that a lot of people, that's a problem for a lot of people. They want to know, does the church, endorse you? And we have good back channel relationships with the church, but that's all they are. And for some people, that means, okay, well then, I'm not going to listen to you. And if that's the case, so be it. So that is an issue with apologetics. Is, some people only care what the brethren in Salt Lake and I think it's going to be a mixed bag. I think some are supportive of apologetics and some less.
I just want to say that I would agree with Kevin. I don't think that there's any consensus among the church leadership on Barnes and the apologetic issues we've been discussing here. I can confirm, I do have the insider information, and can confirm that there was a general authority involved in pulling the John DeLitt article. Yes, I know who it is. No, I won't tell you. I can confirm that the university president supported, Cecil Samuelson supported Gerald Bradford. He didn't initiate it, but he supported after the fact Gerald Bradford's decision to remove Dan Peterson. That is what I was told. So that's about all I know about general authorities and supporting Barnes apologetics.
All right. Hi, I'm Greg Solstrom. I'm a Lutheran pastor living in North Carolina. And though I used to live here, started a church up down in West Jordan years ago, I know nothing about what happened at the Maxwell Institute, and I would like to hear more about it. I like apologetics, apologia, but could you fill me in a little more of the background of what took place? I know about the transfer over to BYU and some of that stuff, back. But what is the controversy that you're talking about?
Yeah, as Kaimi mentioned at the outset, now about a month and a half ago, Dan Peterson, who has long been the editor of one of the organs of the Maxwell Institute, which was originally called the Review of Books on the Book of Mormon, and Farms Review of Books, and then the Farms Review, and then and most recently it's going to be called the Mormon Studies Review. So the name has changed over time for various reasons, but Dan Peterson has been the editor of that, and that organ of Farms has all kinds of things it does, but that organ is probably the most explicitly apologetic aspect of the Maxwell Institute. Dan was in on a lengthy trip in Europe, and received an email from Gerald Bradford, who's the executive director of the Maxwell Institute, that he was being removed as editor of the Farms Review. And now, and as Kaimi alluded to, that that there are aspects to this that are, was this done well? Universities remove people as editors all the time. It didn't have to be quite as controversial as it ended up being. But my guess is that Gerald Bradford, and I don't know him personally, but I respect his scholarship. So again, I'm ambivalent on some of this because I know people on all sides, and I consider myself friends with all of them. But I think Gerald Bradford thought it would be easier to do politically by waiting until Dan was out of the country. And you know, should he have taken advantage of that or sucked it up and done it to his face? You know, they had a meeting face to face before he left, and this never came up. And so there's that aspect to it. But this is all about Dan Peterson, who's a very controversial figure. You know, I talked about these very spheres of apologetics, but they bleed into each other at the margins. And Dan Peterson has been very active on message boards and actually, you know, arguing with individual anti-Mormons on message boards. And so some of that style kind of bleeds in to the Farms Review a little bit. I think that was my attempt to explain what was going on. But Jack can do more deeply.
Part of what escalated the controversy, as Kaimi talked about in the beginning, was that the emails, this email that Bradford sent to Peterson and this email that Peterson sent to Bradford, were leaked, and they were leaked to a figure on a message board who's usually very critical of apologetics and, to a lesser extent, the LDS Church. And, of course, once they were out, they were posted on other sites, and I think any company would be a little embarrassed to have such high-profile emails with containing information about such sensitive information about recent decisions leaked on the internet. Not only that, but before these emails were even sent, there were a couple of posters on this message board who were saying that they had heard that there were going to be big changes at the Maxwell Institute, or that Dan was going to get released. So Dan heard about getting released from, you could say, anti-Mormon critics on a message board before he heard about it from Bradford. And I think that that was very hurtful for him. And who leaked this information? I don't know. It was not the person that feed me my information, in case you're wondering. And no, I did not leak it to the person on the message board who posted it. But we don't know who leaked it. When Dan responded to Gerald, he CC'd the email to 18 people. So some people think that Dan leaked his own email. But him and his friends deny that it was him, or that it was any of the 18 people he CC'd. So we don't know who leaked it. But because of the leak, and because that leak got out, and there was a lot more publicity about it, I think the things really escalated and took a turn for even worse than it already was. So.
And just to clarify, I mean, due to just the way Mormon apologetics has developed over the last decade, in a lot of ways Dan Peterson became the face of a certain type of approach, and because very active on message boards, very active on blogs, such that this was, I think, seen as more than just the removal of an editor. This was at least interpreted by some people, and there's an article by Peggy Fletcher Stack, which you should take a look at in the Salt Lake Tribune, as to whether this should be seen as a repudiation of an entire approach to apologetics, which is at least how some people have cast it.
Just a quick follow-up. I guess the reason for my question, I heard the introduction before, was the reason he was removed. What kind of apologetics was he doing that caused him, do you think, perhaps?
Don't just say a certain kind of apologetics.
Right.
Sure.
I just kind of understand.
At least some observers have argued that Dan is a very aggressive interlocutor in apologetic conversations, and overly dismissive and perhaps hostile to other people who do not deserve such hostility. This has been a criticism, and again, I don't want to... I think that Dan says a lot of things online, and I think many things which he says are funny and are astute. And I think that it's a reputation which is to some extent overstated, but that is a reputation which I think accurately describes how a number of critics see this move as a repudiation of that particular approach.
And one really quick thing that I just, as you, in response to what you just said, I think also in the email it mentioned that there had been a prior discussion with Dan about changing the direction of the Maxwell Institute. But then later on, Bradford said that he didn't feel it was fair to ask Dan to change the direction because he obviously had different ideas about how it should be done. So there was some kind of discussion that had already occurred. But my question, at least a couple of questions, if that's all right. First of all, can a career be made in apologetics? Is it? Bridget? Do you go by Jack or Bridget? Jack. Okay. So I'm just throwing that out there because you mentioned that like no one you knew was going into apologetics, and so and do their mentors ever encourage it? Because I think it's almost looked down upon in the academy. So that was one question. The other one really fast was, to what extent should an organization maintain the mandate it was originally given or adapt to the changing times? Because I think one of the things Dan always argued was, well, we had a general authority. He didn't say who it was. Or I guess it was maybe Maxwell, but he said no slam dunks should be made against the organization, basically unchallenged slam dunks. And so it's interesting because I think that maybe it does make sense to move more into Mormon studies. But on the other hand, he's claiming a certain sort of legitimacy from an authority who approved of what he was doing. So just interesting. I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thanks.
Well, I want to answer your first question. No, a career cannot be made.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how much money you're making.
Although some people who are involved are university professors, and they use skill sets from their academic work in apologetics, so tangentially maybe, but the answer is no.
Well, I wanted to say that I wasn't really envisioning people having careers in apologetics per se. I meant the people who are doing careers in other fields like biblical studies and religious history. They are not choosing to, they don't want to be the next Dan Peterson, editing the journal and regularly contributing to apologetics while holding down their regular PhD positions. I don't see people interested in doing that. In the Christian world, you can definitely, and I'm not saying Mormons aren't Christians, by the way, but in the evangelical Christian world, the rest of the Christian world, you can definitely make a career out of apologetics, but I don't think the same networks are in place to make that happen in Mormonism.
One thing briefly on that, just friends of mine who are in religious studies in general, I think are very interested in showing that they are legitimate scholars in religious studies, and for various reasons, apologetics is not seen as a legitimate type of scholarship in religious studies. It's seen as a sort of, so it becomes a sort of intellectual ghetto of sorts. If you end up as an apologist, this would be seen as bad for your career as a religious studies scholar, and so young people in religious studies who I've talked with are not interested in that for that reason, because they think it would not be helpful for their career, and it could be harmful for their career.
I kind of want to ask a question that somehow relates to the legitimacy of apologetics, and this has kind of been mentioned by several different people, and I know that it has been stated that we probably should not take this one instance as a kind of a general view of a general move against one type of apologetics or whatnot, but it seems to me that the different parties are asserting that, well, what their work is doing is either institutionally supported or it may not be institutionally supported. Or if one person can talk to a general authority and say, this general authority does not like you having this kind of attack style, then they're... I don't want to get too personal on this. I guess what I'm kind of trying to ask is, one of the comments that was made was that maybe it's better for apologists to be this kind of freewheeling kind of organization. But in that case, couldn't we say that other organizations that are not FAIR or FARMS, but that in some way try to help people stay within the church, so they are in some senses providing a case for faith or a defense of the faith? But how do we define apologetics when there is no kind of institutional backing for it? I guess that would be the question. Okay, so let me just kind of put ideas. So suppose that there is something like some kind of, like say Joanna Brooks, or some kind of, they aren't really taking things in a kind of a traditional way, but they're kind of advocating that people live in a very Mormon way. How can we say then, well, this person, even though they're making a case for a faith, you shouldn't listen to them, or they're not apologetics, or something like that, if there's no...
I think I see where you're going with this now. I didn't before. And, people have different points of view. I mean, I love Joanna. And in many ways, what she does is apologetics. She's makes the case, she doesn't work publicly to a non-LDS audience, but she's making the case that you don't have to be stupid, you don't have to check your grade at the door to be a Mormon. And I think apologetics is a much broader thing than many of us think of. I think a lot of people would say, you know, a lot of what Richard Bushman did in Joseph Smith versus Stone Roland is apologetic in some sense. So I think you're right. I think apologetics is actually much more broadly based than we think of. We look at these organizations that are really focused on it. But apologetics is, you know, the blogs. The blogger knackle, much of the blogger knackle is apologetic in some sense. So apologetics is all around us. And I think that was where you're going. I agree with you.
And I think, I mean, to what you said, this is one data point. We tend to construct causal narratives out of too small of data. This is not actually anything that shows for sure that the institution is moving in a particular direction. It's true that we have no, in the LDS Church, there's no officially designated defender of the faith office who officially issues encyclicals or some, you know, whatever it is, some sort of official apologetic organ. And so, to some extent, Farms was the closest that exists. So the fact that we're moving away from that may suggest that the institution is moving in that direction, but we can't really say it's a single data point. One of the things, to Kevin's point about Ruston Rolling, one of the most fascinating things that I remember reading about it is in the in Bushman's book On the Road with Joseph Smith, where he talks about the reactions among church leaders, and that some church leaders were, this is fantastic, this is great, and other church leaders, this book is terrible. It's full of very problematic information. And the fact that there are multiple responses, what is defending the faith? It depends on where the person's faith is and what direction it's headed in. And to some extent, I mean, Kevin has been a big proponent of the inoculation model of apologetics. Let's get information out there. Let's say, yes, Joseph Smith drank coffee. No, it's not a big deal. We changed the rules about 100 years ago. Don't freak out. And that's, I think, a very important potential way to approach it. And yet, for some people who aren't aware of the coffee drinking to begin with, that causes those freak out moments. And so, I mean, Mormon apologists are kind of in an impossible position trying to, if the goal is to keep everybody in the fold at all times, because people have different intellectual needs as far as addressing their concerns. So as far as what this means, I think we're going to continue to see a multifaceted approach because people have different types of needs.
Can you guys respond to that second question of mine about the organization, whether it should change or stay the same when you get a chance?
Yeah.
What was the second question?
To what extent should the organization adapt to the times or maintain its original mandate?
What organization?
The
Farms.
The Institute of Farms.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether there was any general authority impetus behind this move. Jack has mentioned that there was some involved in the John DeLynn paper. Someone wrote a paper critiquing John DeLynn's work, about a 100-page paper, and John got wind of it and contacted a general authority and asked if he thought this was a good thing for Farms to be doing, and that was part of how this all got going. So yes, there was a general authority involved in the John DeLynn paper, and I think that was perhaps an opportunity for Gerald Bradford to do something that. There's been a part of Farms that has been wanting to do this probably for years. There's been kind of an anti-apologetic school within Farms. And I know that sounds weird to people because people think of Farms, you know, as monolithic. But, you know, it's like any academic institution. There are politics involved. And there are politics. You know, when I was an undergrad at BYU, you know, the politics involved with the religion were the dirtiest, you know, of the whole university. And I tend to look at it through rose-colored glasses now, but I remember when I left BYU, being very glad to see Provo in my rearview mirror because of the politics that went on. And I see this in that light. I mean, this is academic politics at BYU. And I'm not convinced that this was a general authority-driven thing. I think Jerry Bradford has been trying to do this for some time, and he saw an opportunity based on this dust up over the Dillon paper, and he took advantage of it. And it was a deft political move. It probably wasn't, it was handled ham-handedly with all this leaking emails, and it got very public very fast. So as far as what the institution of the church and its attitude towards apologetics, I think it remains a mixed bag. I think some authorities favor it and some probably don't.
Hi, my name is Joshua. I was going to register for the conference, but unfortunately I have to work during most of it. So my question is one of, I mean, at the end of the day, though, you know, Mormon apologetics, just like every other apologetics for every other religion, is kind of, they couch it in a lot of terms, but it's kind of a spin on reality where you try to defend the views of your religion. And my question is, I mean, with the increasingly secular society that we're living in, with kind of like this understanding that people are developing more and more, that there's an independent objective reality out there that's independent of our, I guess, kind of our biases and our perceptions of it, that the universe, you know, independent, that operates more or less independently of humanity. And also in increasingly advancing secular morality, you know, where people look at things that they would have once not even worried about, you know, I don't know, like the flood of Noah or something like that, and say, oh, well, in kind of, you know, the subjective secular morality that we have, you know, this doesn't seem to be a good thing, you know, that all these people drown in the flood. How does apologetics cope with that? Not only Mormon apologetics, but like apologetics in general. I mean, at the end of the day, don't you kind of have to throw up your hands and say, well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to have to defend, you know, a God that drowns all of his kids except for eight, you know, and things of that nature. I mean, how do you kind of like deal with that?
Well, I don't know that there is necessarily an objective reality. There's a statement from the Talmud that instead of, you know, we often see things as they are, but instead we see things as we are. And that's actually been a big issue in apologetics, kind of positivism versus, you know, postmodernism. And it's just too big an issue to try to respond to here, but that is an issue that is discussed a lot in apologetic discourse.
I think I would very much disagree. I think science has shown, you know, that there is some such thing as an objective reality. I mean, consistently. So for example, if your computer stops working, it's not because it became haunted or something like that.
Study philosophy.
Yeah.
Okay. I study science, but
that's so why I study philosophy.
Okay, but that's cool. We can agree to disagree about that.
Okay,
thanks.
And it's a great question. Roll into the earlier question about adaptation. I think apologetics has adapted to a world in which we have different assumptions about the role of religion. And when you look at Mormon apologetics over the last decades, it used to be, look at those Indian burial mounds, and here are some really cool things, and this is all shows that there was this wonderful Nephite civilization, and now all of a sudden, let's talk about a limited geography theory, because perhaps the archaeological finds don't actually support what we may have thought they supported. But ultimately, what it gives people is something to hang their hat on if they want to remain believers in the community. So they can say, you know, you haven't proven that the Book of Mormon is false, because maybe it's it's the case that if you read Sorensen and you think that maybe it all happened in a particular limited geography, maybe it's the case that even if there aren't any people with particular DNA, that's because they just didn't get into the gene pool enough. And so it's a way of saying the case against Mormonism has not been proven. So to Jack's point about sort of proving the point, you know, proving the case of Mormonism, at least so far the recent trend has been disproving attempts to, or invalidating attempts to positively disprove Mormonism. And that's something which can be a very just spiritually, psychologically comforting space for people, knowing that, you know, if I have doubts, if somebody has doubts, that at least there has not been a slam dunk case made that the Book of Mormon is absolutely false, because maybe it all happened in Guatemala in a particular context, and that's why the runes and swords don't show up the way that they might otherwise do. And so you haven't proven Mormonism false, and therefore I'm not a complete idiot if I remain in this faith. And that's, I think that can be valuable, because people find value in remaining in the faith, and if they want to, this can provide them with an intellectual vehicle for finding sort of personal integrity in remaining in the faith. And we are flat out of time, so thank you to our presenters.